It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, we assess the crisis in Iraq and its ramifications for the region. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. In a dramatic reversal, Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki announced that he will step aside and support his designated successor. The announcement Thursday came hours after Mr. Maliki claimed the president's nomination of Haider al-Abadi was illegal and that he would fight it in court. The new prime minister is tasked with uniting Iraq's various ethnic and religious groups in an effort to defuse the threat by the Islamic State militants advancing from the north. Prime Minister-designate al-Abadi promised to rebuild and retrain Iraq's army in order to defeat Islamist militants, to create a strong and inclusive government, and to fight corruption. Iraq is now locked in a vicious struggle for its survival, fueled by Shiite-Sunni violence, the failure of the Maliki government, and the creation of the Islamic State, also known as ISIL, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, which has captured large swaths of territory in western and northern Iraq. More than a week ago, U.S. President Barack Obama authorized targeted airstrikes and emergency assistance in northern Iraq to protect American personnel, to stop the IS militants from closing in on the Kurdish city of Erbil, and to alleviate a humanitarian catastrophe that had befallen thousands of members of the Yazidi religious minority fleeing the town of Sinjar. In addition to airstrikes, the United States has sent hundreds of military advisors to assist both the Kurdish security forces, known as the Peshmerga, who have borne the brunt of the IS onslaught, as well as to the central forces in Baghdad. Meantime, European Union foreign ministers have been holding emergency talks aimed at coming up with a unified response to arming the Kurds. Many analysts say that Washington now needs to assemble a combined Iraq-Syria strategy to have any chance of containing the Islamic State, which has consolidated its power in northern Syria, especially in the city of Raqqa. Well, for more on international efforts, both political and military, to stop ISIL's advance and to stabilize Iraq, we turn to two distinguished regional analysts. Edmund Gharib is professor of Middle East history and politics at American University and is the first Mustafa Barzani scholar of global Kurdish studies at the AU Center for Global Peace. And Faisal Itani, he's resident fellow at the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council. That's a policy group based here in Washington. And Faisal is a Middle East analyst who focuses on the Levant, including Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and Jordan. Well, both panelists join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Well, Edmund Gharib, let me begin with you. Now that Prime Minister Maliki has agreed to step aside, what does this mean for the current state of affairs, both in trying to contain and thwart the onslaught of ISIS and for the possibility of a more inclusive government?
Before I answer that question, I would like to point out one thing. I want to say that you were one of the few journalists, and your program was one of the few programs which focused on the plight of minorities in the Middle East. All people, for example, have suffered in Iraq, Sunnis, Shia, Turkmen, Kurds, Christians, Alawis, but I think the minorities suffered more, not necessarily because of what happened to them or there were more of them who suffered, but because of their small numbers in the area. And some of these ethnic and religious minorities faced and are facing extinction, like the Sabaean community probably will be finished in Iraq. The Christians, who are one of the oldest Christian communities in the world, for that matter, not just in the Middle East, going back to the first century AD, their numbers went down from 1.1, 1.2 million. If there are 300,000 left, that would be a large number. And I want to say that you were one of the few, actually, early on who realized, and that I think credit should be given where credit is due.
Well, thanks to you for helping us talk about these communities and their plight so it's a two-way street.
Thank you. But the point that you mentioned about Prime Minister Maliki, I think this is a very significant development. And not necessarily because I expect that Iraq's problems are going to end or that there will not be challenges before this government, but I think where the change is that Maliki was moving in the direction of a dead end. And Iraq was going almost to the edge of the abyss, if it wasn't already. But I think right now there is a new opportunity. There is a chance. There are some signs that maybe some of the Iraqi leaders with help from abroad, and they are becoming aware of the dangers to themselves and to the country as a whole, and therefore are making some steps that are probably going to help promote more understanding. And if we see a government, not only a government of national unity, but a real government that's going to be representative of all of Iraq's communities, be they Sunni, be they Shia, be they Turkoman, be they Kurd, I think that's going to be very significant. Taking into account the realities on the ground, there's, however, another problem, and this is the need for structural reform of the Iraqi government. Unless there is a structural reform, we're going to have a big, big problem down the road, because as long as people think of themselves as Sunnis and Shias and Kurds and Turkmen and Christians and Yazidis or whatever, that is a problem. And the problem also goes back to some of the decisions made after the invasion of Iraq in 2003, when Iraqis were dealt with as communities rather than also as Iraqis. And one of the most important things, the policies which were followed led to the Lebanonization of Iraq. And we are paying the price for it today.
Turning to you, Faisal Itani, Edmund Garib brings up so many important points. The fact that Iraq is a country that is made up of so many communities, Christian, there were Jews, Yazidis, not only Muslims of Shia and Sunni sects, and how to get back to this sense of unity of the Iraqi identity, and to what extent does Maliki's decision to step aside perhaps help get us toward that? How significant is his departure and the nomination of Haider al-Abadi?
I think his agreement to give up the post of the premiership helped avoid violence within Baghdad and between the rival Shia communities, first and foremost. So that has removed the potentially greatly complicating factor on the road to reform and an outreach to the other communities in the country. I do share Edmond's concern that I think Maliki is himself a problem in the way he's governed and manipulated the Iraqi institutions, but also think obviously the problem with Iraq's politics and their dysfunction runs a lot deeper than that. It's the nature of governance, the structure of the state itself, and their relationships with the communities that are not as heavily represented as the Shia political establishment in Baghdad. So it's disaster avoidance. But I certainly don't call it a solution, no.
Well, back to you, Edmund Garib. To look at the other aspects of trying to contain and reverse ISIL's advance, what is your assessment of the impact and the effect of the U.S. strategy of these airstrikes, the stepped-up support for the Kurdish militia, the Peshmerga, and, of course, the attempts to try to protect the minority Yazidi population?
This is something that's very complex. On the one hand, President Obama was very careful about sending military support to the Iraqi government. And part of the reason why I think he did that was primarily because he wanted to put pressure on Prime Minister Maliki to either change his policies and the direction in which he was taking Iraq, but also to perhaps put pressure so that others would also come to the decision that maybe it's time for Mr. Maliki to leave the scene as Prime Minister of Iraq. Nevertheless, this creates a lot of problems. First, on the American level, President Obama was the president who was elected to a large extent because he promised to get the American forces out of Iraq, because he argued the decision to go to war was a wrong decision. This is also a slippery slope whereby you begin to send forces. Yes, this was a humanitarian crisis. There was a failure on the part of the various powerful forces on the ground to move to help the Yazidis and the Christians and others. But at the same time, there is a need to confront this extremist organization. But I think probably the best way would be first to get the Iraqis themselves, to provide them with the support, to get a government of national unity, a government that's going to represent all Iraqis, and a government that's going to look at this threat as a threat to all Iraqis, provide them with military, diplomatic support is probably the best way, and also get the United Nations in. That's probably the best way to move, rather than to begin to put boots on the ground, because that is not going to be seen as part of the solution, but as a part of the problem.
Turning to you, Faisal Itani, for your assessment of the U.S. role so far, the airstrikes, the support particularly to the Peshmerga forces as well as to Baghdad, that's certainly not nearly enough, but how do you see the U.S. role going forward?
Let me take a slightly different angle on how I see the motivations and the trajectory of the policy. I think the humanitarian aspect was not non-existent, but a secondary factor in the decision to intervene to the extent to which the United States has. I believe this was a gradual realization that the ISIS problem and their military momentum had gotten out of hand, and that something needed to be done to shore up the Kurdish position and, if you will, contain the Islamic State, not defeat it. There was, of course, the benefit that beleaguered refugees were rescued, but if that were the criteria for U.S. action, then I would indeed be worried about a slippery slope, because there are so many people in grave danger in both Iraq and Syria. I think President Obama has been extremely disciplined about it. I don't think this will turn into the sort of broad humanitarian intervention. If it hasn't already over the past 3 years, I don't think it will do so now. I think the policy will continue to be one of containment while Iraq gets its house in order, if indeed it does. The president's view is that taking it much further beyond that is probably an overly ambitious policy, given the realities on the ground. The problem is this indicates a real mismatch of ambition between the Islamic State and what they're trying to achieve and what the United States is willing and able to do as the president sees it. ISIS can live with a containment strategy. They're a state-building organization before anything else. And as long as they're able to consolidate control of territory, resources, and protect their lines of communication, they're perfectly happy for the situation to stay as it is in Iraq. Indeed, they are actually expanding westwards into Syria and making dramatic gains there.
Well, back to you, Edmund Garib. As I said in the introduction, as of course Faisal alluded to, ISIL is a very strong organization. It really has consolidated itself in Syria. And many analysts now are saying that to defeat the Islamic State in Iraq, we also have to look at its territorial gains and influence now in Syria in its effort to pretty much hammer the secular opposition at the same time to combat Bashar al-Assad. What do you think about some kind of a two-pronged approach? Do you believe that either the United States and other international actors should try also to attack ISIL in Syria? What are your thoughts?
So basically, I just want to say a couple of words about what Faisal said. One is that, you know, President Obama clearly used the humanitarian threat to the Yazidis, basically to mobilize support for his decision. First, it was the Yazidis, it was the defense of Erbil. Then it was, of course, any threat to Baghdad, threat to U.S. personnel in Erbil and other places. And then we also began to hear about the infrastructure. I think there was a growing realization about the danger of the Islamic State, basically because this organization is different from other groups. This organization has shown itself to be, it's extremely brutal. It's very harsh in dealing with everybody who disagrees with it. Nevertheless, I think they also think strategically. The expansion of their positions in both Syria and in Iraq, the fact that they took control of strategic roads, transportation areas, lines of communications, dams, the dam at Haditha, the dam in Al-Mosul, oil and gas fields, and the moving of their forces and the areas under their control all the way to Jalula on the borders with Iran to Sinjar, which is on the border of Syria and Turkey. And this, to me, says that these people have a vision and that they are much better at strategy than many people had predicted. As to the way to combat this, I think there are now different views. The view that says you cannot deal with them separately, that the U.S. has to intervene in Syria, and that even before they go after ISIS or the Islamic State, they have to go after the Syrian regime, and that was a big mistake, in fact, not to go against the regime earlier. And that's what actually Secretary Clinton mentioned recently. There is also another view, which we began to see, as Faisal was mentioning earlier, some senior U.S. diplomats saying, well, the threat in Syria Syria is not the regime. The regime may be the lesser of two evils. The threat is ISIS and radical organizations. And perhaps it's time to have a truce with the Syrian regime. So this debate is going to be there for a while, and I don't see it being resolved anytime soon. But I think the best thing to do, as I said before, is basically to get the forces on the ground, the people on the ground, to launch a campaign. And this would be the most effective campaign to deal with the threat. Because in the end, ISIS is still a small organization. And it gained support because many of the people who are supporting it, other than the jihadis who are coming from abroad, felt that they were oppressed. And they wanted to vent their frustration, their anger. And they saw in this organization a group that maybe could challenge the existing order.
Turning to you, Faisal Ithani, there's no question that ISIS or IS, however you want to call them, was a refuge for many disaffected Sunnis, particularly in Iraq. They did not feel that their grievances were taken into consideration at all, were not part of the predominantly Shiite-led government of Nouri al-Maliki. But back to how to defeat ISIS, and I'm going to quote from a senior strategic communications advisor for the Syrian opposition coalition, saying that to protect Erbil and Iraqi Christians from the Islamic State, the United States must hit the Islamic State in Syria. So there's that theory that to truly defeat it, not just have a different political structure, a more inclusive one, not only to just hit it in Iraq, Islamic State, but we need to look to Syria as well.
The Islamic State itself obviously, it doesn't ideologically differentiate between Syria and Iraq, but its strategy is adaptive, and they've taken a somewhat different approach to the local populations. As Edmond has described in Iraq, they have exploited this Sunni disaffection with the central government. The Iraqi regime is a bit more, for many reasons, redeemable than the Syrian one, and therefore you can imagine a political arrangement in which you could wean the Sunni population away from ISIS. Syria is a different dynamic. The Sunni population is in a popular military uprising against Assad, but also, and this is the remarkable and the variable here, is that they've been fighting ISIS for a year and a half in an ongoing confrontation at great cost, and they're now in military peril themselves, while at the same time they've been fighting the regime. There is already a tool and mechanism to work with in Syria. There is already a degree of popular mobilization against ISIS. The trouble is that people are increasingly going to calculate that it's probably wiser to bet on ISIS than to resist, because anybody who has resisted in northern and northeastern Syria has been more or less crushed. And this is going on as we speak around Aleppo. The strategic depth they enjoy, the control of oil resources, the control of territory, and the fact that they are steadily expanding in Syria means displacing them from certain key parts of Iraq will certainly be a blow to them. But if the aim is to defeat them, then there has to be a Sunni political and military solution. Any other solution than that is going to be framed in sectarian terms. The fact that the Sunnis in Syria are still not able to provide an alternative to ISIS, still not able to push them back, and still not able to deliver military gains against the regime, means the ISIS narrative is going to be the one that wins the day.
Is it too late for that strategy? Many have said, as Edmond said, that former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton wanted to help support the secular opposition, both militarily and politically, back in 2012. She said not doing so left a vacuum, in fact, for the jihadis to come in. We also know that Bashar al-Assad, rather than attack ISIS, he often attacks the more secular opposition and civilians. So there's a strange symbiosis between ISIS and the regime, even though, of course, both say they're fighting each other. Is it too late now to try to bolster the secular opposition, whatever is left of it, in Syria?
Let me address the two issues you raised separately. Is it too late? Emphatically, no. Numerically, they far outnumber ISIS, and they also have a much healthier relationship with local populations. They are fighting and present in more geographies, and they simply have the numbers that ISIS does not have. ISIS is a few thousand people. You're talking about tens of thousands of, I'm not going to call them all secularists because that's not true, but they are not jihadists, and they are hostile to ISIS. The question of too late or not, it's more difficult now than it was. But on the other hand, some of these groups have managed to consolidate over the past 2 years and managed to get their act together slightly more than they had before. Or they are still severely lacking in supplies, organization, training, and equipment, of course. But that is something that can be remedied with effort. The other issue you raised was one of the regime-ISIS dynamic and whether or not one or the other was the lesser of two evils. It is true that the regime and ISIS stayed out of one another's way, because their immediate objectives were to take territory and crush the opposition that was on both groups' respective front lines. Assad wanted to secure Homs, Hama, Halab, and Damascus, and ISIS were not really active on those fronts. ISIS was fighting in the northeast, setting up their state. Now what's happening is, now that ISIS is moving west and south, they're coming into contact with the regime. And this de facto sort of leave me alone, I'll leave you alone, that's done now. They're actively fighting both the regime and the moderate opposition, and they're making some pretty significant gains.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Edmond Garib. He's professor of Middle East history and politics at American University and the first Mustafa Barzani scholar of global Kurdish studies at AU Center for Global Peace. And Faisal Itani. He's resident fellow at the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council. That's a policy group based in Washington. We're discussing how the United States and its allies can ultimately slow and defeat the extremists from the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL, who have been seizing large swaths of Iraqi territory and creating a humanitarian disaster by terrorizing the minority communities of Yazidis and Christians. This is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/encounter. And please like and leave a comment on our Facebook page, facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA. Well, back to you, Edmond Garib. Let's quickly take a look now at the possibility of this new Iraqi prime minister, to what extent he can form a more inclusive government. And do you think that this change of leadership could help soothe Iraq's sectarian fractures and unite the country against ISIS? Can he peel off the Sunnis who have sided with ISIL against Maliki and, of course, the Shiite-dominated Iraqi security forces?
The real point, I think, when it comes to Iraq, I think the challenge is going to be extremely difficult. But we're beginning to see changes on the ground. Today, I read a report that the Kurds have returned some of the oil facilities in Kirkuk to the central authority. If this is true, this is a significant development, and I think this may be a sign of goodwill, the need to cooperate, to work together. The other important development that is very significant is that some of the regional actors, such as Iran, played an extremely important role here in pushing, helping push, or making the decision, influencing the decision of some of its allies in Baghdad. Also, I think the international community has played an important role. We're seeing an increasing role for the Europeans also, not just the United States, but even beyond that. And I think these are important. So there is a chance, there is an opportunity, but we'll have to wait and see. The problems are big.
Well, Edmond, you pointed out two very important points that I wanted to get to before we close the program, the role of the Kurds and, of course, the changing geopolitical landscape. And, of course, what you're saying is that perhaps now the Kurds, who have previously talked about independence, perhaps they're going to put that on the back burner for a while to see if a new, more inclusive government can help unite the country. Back to you, Faisal Itani, for your take on to what extent this new Iraqi government, new leadership, al-Abadi, can in fact help to soothe Iraq's sectarian fractures, unite the country against ISIS, and peel off those Sunnis who have previously sided with ISIL because they could not abide Maliki and this heavy-handed forces against them.
I do think it's a significant accomplishment. I do think Maliki's departure is a very positive thing. I think Iraqi politics and Shia politics is much more complex than it is in Syria. And I think their ability to reach out and offer the Sunnis a solution depends on their ability to agree on a common agenda and what sort of relationship Baghdad wants to have with the Kurds and with the Sunnis. It's now become a question of more than just convincing the Sunnis. Now it's a question of capability as well. However convinced they are, however tempted they are, if they calculate that they cannot fight and win against ISIS, then the rational thing to do is to come to terms with it. They have been increasingly doing that in northeast Syria, simply because they've realized they're outmatched. And I worry, I think just want to raise the concern that whatever the Baghdad government does, if ISIS remains capable, powerful, sophisticated in its handling of local populations and administration, it will be a little more difficult to dislodge than just a political agreement between Sunnis and Shia.
One more question before we close. So back to you, Edmond Garib. You talked about the geopolitical landscape, the role of Iran. Interestingly, we have Iran and the United States on the same side here in Iraq. To some extent, they're both against the advance of ISIL. Of course, they probably have very different interests at the end of the day. But what about combating ISIL in the end? What is the role of Saudi Arabia and Qatar, these two Persian Gulf Sunni states?
The consequences of the Iraq war the establishment of a government in Baghdad that was perceived by the Saudi Arabia and some of the other Gulf states as pro-Iran. They saw it as the allies of Iran have taken over Baghdad. They perceived it to be a threat to the regional stability. Iraq, even under the sanctions, it was a stabilizer. It was a buffer for the other Arab countries, defense against Iran. But when Iraq collapsed, the strategic balance was finished, and that's why we saw the policies which were pursued by some of the Gulf states. But one positive thing, extremely positive point, is that first we have seen statements and positions taken by the Saudi government that there's a recognition that the Islamic State, that the extremist jihadi groups pose a threat not only to in Syria or in Iraq, but to the whole region. And that's significant. The message that of support and the phone call to Prime Minister-designate al-Abadi by the Saudi king, I think, is also a significant development. That's why I think perhaps there is maybe even a chance on the regional level. Lebanon, we're seeing some interesting developments taking place with the return of Prime Minister al-Hariri. So I think there is, hopefully, a new environment, a new atmosphere.
And the last word to you, Faisal Itani.
I don't think this is an alliance against ISIL. I think this is a convergence of interests, and the fact that nobody has an interest in ISIL taking over Iraq doesn't mean that they now share common broader strategic interests. The Iranian regime's interests and Assad's interests remains the hegemonic influence over Iraq and keeping Assad in power as a link to Hezbollah in Lebanon. It is true that the Saudis and Qataris don't want to see ISIS winning this battle, but they're not in a position to defeat ISIS. They were never really significant in its rise, contrary to popular perceptions. ISIS is independently funded and quite capable of taking care of itself. The major negative role the Qataris and Saudis had is in the degree to which they helped fragment the Syrian opposition with their infighting. That led to extreme infighting, extreme divisions, lack of coordination, and that was direct empowerment of ISIS. I think beyond what they've already done, what are they going to give the United States and Iran? According to them, they have a U.S. president who is at best indifferent to their interests, if not actively hostile to them. He refuses to look out for their interests in Syria. He's done very little to address their interests in Iraq. As they see it, yes, they don't want to get attacked by ISIS. They are, of course, an enemy of theirs, but they're not going to put themselves on the line to support an agenda that, in the long term, doesn't benefit them.
All right. Well, on that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Edmund Gharib, he's professor of Middle East History and Politics at American University, and Faisal Itani, resident fellow at the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council. Gentlemen, thank you for your fabulous insights. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Jackson Witt. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Encounter on The Voice of America. Encounter on The Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.